This program is produced and provided by lawyer Kyung Jin Kim.
Picture this, all right. It is 1978. You are in Portland, Oregon, and it's the dead of night.
Oh, the graveyard shift.
Exactly. You've just walked into this 24-hour Denny's diner, and the air inside is just thick.
Right, that heavy diner air.
Yeah, it's this crazy sensory mix of steam, the sharp smell of old cooking grease, and, you know, that sweet lingering scent of cheap pancake syrup.
I can literally smell it just from you describing it.
Right. And if you look past the counter, back into the harsh fluorescent glare of the kitchen, you see this 15-year-old boy.
Just a kid, really.
Just a kid. He's a recent immigrant standing at this massive industrial sink. His hands are scalding red from the boiling hot water, and he is just scrubbing.
Scrubbing everything.
Ketchup, hardened egg yolk, grease, just this endless towering mountain of dirty plates.
It's definitely not the image you conjure up when you think of the origins of a modern tech empire.
Not at all.
We have this really pervasive cultural tendency, I think, to believe that technological history is always made in like pristine Silicon Valley laboratories.
Right. By people who were just born coding in a garage.
Exactly. But so often, the reality of world-changing innovation is much more grounded in absolute, unglamorous grit.
Well, and that 15-year-old boy scrubbing plates, that is Jensen Huang.
The man himself.
The guy who will one day be known as the Caesar of Silicon, right?
Actually.
The CEO and co-founder of NVIDIA.
Yep.
And today's deep dive is exploring a highly specific, honestly fascinating biographical chapter about his origins.
Because the mission here isn't just to recite a standard biography. We want to trace exactly how the grueling lessons learned in that diner booth literally forged the architecture of a trillion-dollar company.
Yeah, the continuity of his character is just incredible.
It really is what makes this story worth telling. I mean, the teenager at that sink and the billionaire CEO running NVIDIA today, they're driven by the exact same internal engine.
So he was working at that Denny's from, what, 1978 to 1983?
Roughly, yeah. And he wasn't just enduring the job, you know, or quietly counting down the minutes until his shift ended. He actively declared himself, and he literally still says this today, he declared himself the best dishwasher.
The best dishwasher. I love that. He didn't just wash dishes. He systemized the entire physical space.
Totally.
Like, he created this incredibly strict personal rule for himself.
Mm.
He said he would never, ever walk empty-handed.
Oh, yeah. The efficiency rule.
Right. If he was taking a stack of clean plates out to the dining room floor, he mandated that he had to find a task on the way back.
Clearing a table. Grabbing a dirty mug.
Wiping a counter, exactly. He just refused to waste a single physical movement.
And to a teenager, that is a profound level of focus. Wasting time or motion wasn't just lazy to him. It was almost physically intolerable.
He was completely obsessed with efficiency.
He really was. And eventually they promoted him to busboy and then to waiter.
Which was actually a huge deal for him, right?
Oh, it was terrifying for him. Because he was a deeply shy, introverted kid. He was highly self-conscious about his English.
Yeah, but he forced himself to walk right into that discomfort.
Exactly.
You know, I look at what he was doing in that diner, and my mind immediately maps it to how a computer operates.
Oh, that's a good point.
Jensen was essentially treating his physical movements like an algorithm.
Yeah, optimizing his own bandwidth.
Exactly. He was actively trying to reduce latency between the dining room and the sink. It's like he was planting the psychological seeds for semiconductor data pipelines right there in the dish pit.
He really was building the mental framework for data throughput before he even possessed the engineering vocabulary to describe it.
Wow.
He was creating these closed-loop systems of efficiency, and that established his core professional philosophy, which is basically, no task is beneath me.
Which is so rare for a CEO of his level.
It is. Jensen proudly admits that during those Denny's years, he cleaned more toilets than anyone else.
He actually jokes about that, right?
Yeah, he jokes that he has probably cleaned more toilets than all of us combined.
And that directly translates to how he operates today.
Mm-hmm.
Because he operates with a famously flat corporate structure at NVIDIA.
He does. If there is a massive bottleneck in the supply chain or a bug in the code, he doesn't just sit in an executive boardroom and demand status reports.
He gets right in there.
He dives into the problem alongside his engineers. He gets his hands dirty because, psychologically, he still views himself as the guy responsible for scrubbing the floors.
He believes you cannot lead a complex system if you are unwilling to engage with its messiest parts.
Exactly.
Which actually brings up a rather controversial quote he gave during a commencement speech at Stanford.
Oh, I know the one you're talking about.
Yeah, he looked out at all these incredibly bright, hopeful graduates and said, "My greatest advantage is that my expectations are low. Mm-hmm. I wish you ample doses of pain and suffering."
It is a striking thing to say, right?
Yeah.
Especially to people celebrating a massive achievement.
Okay, wait, I have to challenge this a bit.
Before.
Let's unpack this. Because it's so easy for a billionaire to stand at a podium and romanticize his painful graveyard shifts.
Sure, I hear that.
Isn't this classic survivorship bias? Like, for most people, profound sleep deprivation and blistered hands don't magically lead to a trillion-dollar tech empire.
Right, they just lead to burnout.
Exactly. So why on earth is he prescribing pain to Stanford grads?
That is a very fair critique, but you have to look at how he defines that pain.
Okay.
He isn't prescribing, like, abuse or systemic poverty. He is warning them about the fragility of high expectations.
Ah, I see.
Those Stanford graduates have been told their entire lives that they are the elite, that the world is just waiting for them.
Right, that everything will be smooth sailing.
Exactly. Yeah. And Jensen's point is that when you expect success, the first encounter with severe, unyielding friction can just completely shatter you.
So he found actual power in enduring that discomfort early on.
Yeah. He learned that pain isn't a signal to stop. It's the friction required to season you for leadership.
Okay. I see the distinction there, but I'm stuck on something else.
What's that?
Being a hyper-efficient dishwasher is fantastic for building character and grit. But grit alone doesn't magically teach you how to engineer microchips.
No, it definitely doesn't.
How exactly did he bridge the gap from buzzing tables to the upper echelons of computer engineering?
Well, he bridged it with the exact same calculated intensity he used in the diner.
Makes sense.
By the time he was 17, he had already skipped two grades.
Wow. 17?
Yeah. He enrolls as a freshman at Oregon State University, majoring in electrical engineering. And he is the absolute youngest student in a notoriously difficult class of 250 people.
And we need to paint the picture of what a 1980s electrical engineering class looked like.
Right, the demographic.
Out of those 250 students, only three were women.
Yep. And one of those three women was a 19-year-old named Lori Mills.
Okay, so she's older than him.
She is. And the professor assigned her to be Jensen's lab partner.
Naturally.
Jensen is immediately smitten, but he doesn't use, like, traditional charm. Mm-hmm. He deploys what might be the most unorthodox, purely engineering-minded courtship strategy ever recorded.
I can't wait for this.
He walks up to her and asks, "Do you want to see my homework?"
Okay, I have to be honest here.
Yeah.
If a 17-year-old came up to me and proposed a contract saying, "Study with me every Sunday, and I guarantee you an A in every class."
Which is exactly what he said.
I would think he was insufferably arrogant. How did she not just laugh him right out of the laboratory?
Because it wasn't arrogance, actually. It was this deeply calculated vulnerability, and Lori was perceptive enough to see the difference.
Vulnerability? How so?
You have to understand his reality at that moment. He was 17, but he looked even younger.
Oh, right.
He later admitted he felt like he looked like a literal child sitting in that classroom.
That's tough.
He knew he couldn't compete on traditional collegiate swagger, so he put his absolute best product in the window.
His intellect.
Precisely.
Yeah.
He had already finished all the homework perfectly before the weekend even started.
Oh, wow.
He wanted Lori to see the massive discrepancy between his boyish physical appearance and his rigorous, mature intellect.
He was effectively saying, "I know I don't look the part, but look at what I'm capable of building."
Exactly. And she saw past the bravado and recognized a genuine, intense drive.
So they started these Sunday dates,
which were really just the two of them sitting in a quiet corner of the library for hours, drawing complex circuit diagrams and solving advanced equations.
He was maximizing his time with her by intertwining it with the work.
Very efficient.
And it's during this period, when he's just 20 years old, that he makes her a seemingly impossible promise.
This is wild.
He looks at Lori and says, "I'm going to be a CEO by the time I'm 30.
I mean, a 20-year-old kid drawing circuits in a library declaring he would conquer the corporate world in exactly one decade.
It sounds crazy.
He has since admitted he had absolutely no idea how business actually worked when he said it.
Of course not.
But it wasn't an empty boast. It was a statement of intent. He was laying down a hard, inescapable deadline for his own ambition.
And Lori believed him.
She did.
They get married in 1984, the same year he graduates. And what strikes me about their partnership is that they quite literally share the same technical language.
That's a great way to put it.
Lori was a brilliant engineer in her own right. She went on to design microchips at Hewlett-Packard. They didn't just share a life. They share the language of voltage, current, and semiconductor physics.
And that shared foundation is critical to understanding NVIDIA's survival later on.
Oh, for sure.
Let's look ahead to 1996 for a moment. NVIDIA is facing imminent bankruptcy. They are literally 30 days away from running out of payroll and closing their doors forever.
30 days. That is stressful.
A traditional spouse might panic or demand he quit and get a safe job.
Understandably.
But Lori didn't panic. Because she didn't just blindly trust her husband, she understood the fundamental physics of the technology he was trying to build.
He knew the chips were viable.
Yes. She was his emotional bedrock because she shared his technical conviction.
That is a true partnership right there. And fast forward to today, their two kids, Spencer and Madison, both actually work at NVIDIA.
Which is awesome.
And Jensen and Lori recently donated $50 million back to Oregon State University to build a collaborative innovation complex.
It brings that entire romance, which started over library circuit boards, completely full circle.
It really does. But if we trace the timeline back to the mid-80s, right after they graduated,
right,
we have to look at how he actually went about keeping that absurd promise of becoming a CEO by 30.
Because a bachelor's degree, even with the highest honors, wasn't going to be enough to build the specific future he envisioned.
No. Making a bold promise to your girlfriend in a library is easy. Executing it in the bloodthirsty, hyper-competitive landscape of Silicon Valley is another entirely.
So the hustle begins.
Where does he go first?
He takes a job at AMD to learn the absolute fundamentals of microprocessors.
Okay.
Then he moves over to LSI Logic. And LSI was a pioneer in custom semiconductors. He quickly rises to a director role there.
And this is where the diner mentality, that graveyard shift resilience, comes roaring back.
Oh, absolutely. Because during this rapid corporate ascent at LSI Logic, he is also raising a young family with Lori.
Right.
And on top of the day job and the parenting, he secretly enrolls at Stanford University for his master's degree.
Wait, going to Stanford at night? I want to pause on the sheer physical reality of this.
It's intense.
He is working a brutal tech job by day.
Mm-hmm.
He is a dad and a husband. And he is taking classes at one of the most intellectually rigorous engineering schools on the planet by night.
Yeah, he was running on fumes and raw ambition.
That's insane.
He was, but Stanford was the crucial intellectual crucible. The goal wasn't just to collect a prestigious piece of paper.
What was it then?
Stanford taught him a framework called first principles thinking.
Now, first principles is a term that gets thrown around Silicon Valley a lot today, usually as a buzzword.
Oh, constantly.
What did it actually mean for Jensen in the late 80s?
It meant stripping away all the assumptions of the current industry. Most companies look at what exists and try to make it, like, 5% better.
Incremental progress.
Exactly. First principles thinking forces you to stop asking what to build and start asking why you were building it.
So breaking it down.
You break a complex problem down to its fundamental absolute truths, the literal physics of the problem, and build up from there, completely ignoring how everyone else has solved it.
And that specific mindset shift is the exact catalyst for everything that comes next.
It is.
Because while working at LSI Logic, he meets two veteran engineers, Chris Malachowski and Curtis Prime.
Yep, they had come from Sun Microsystems.
And the three of them start talking after work, applying this first principles logic to the future of computing.
Now, you have to understand the computing landscape in the early 90s.
Set the scene.
Standard PCs were fundamentally limited. They were basically glorified calculators that could handle text and very basic 2D graphics.
Right, like MS-DOS or early Windows.
Exactly. If you wanted to run complex 3D graphics, you needed a highly specialized, dedicated workstation from a company like Sun Microsystems, and it would cost you tens of thousands of dollars.
But Jensen and his co-founders asked the why.
Yep.
Why does a consumer PC only have to be a typewriter? Why can't a regular desktop computer process massive, movie-like 3D graphics?
And the answer was because of the architecture of the processor. And here is where first principles come in.
Okay.
A CPU is incredibly smart. Think of a CPU as a brilliant mathematics professor. They can solve incredibly complex logic problems, but they have to do it sequentially.
One problem at a time.
Right. That is fine for loading a Word document, but 3D graphics require calculating the light, shadow, and color of millions of individual pixels simultaneously.
Wait, this is the diner analogy coming completely full circle.
Exactly.
A CPU is like having one incredibly fast, brilliant waiter trying to serve an entire restaurant sequentially.
Yes, it creates a bottleneck.
But to render 3D graphics, you don't need one brilliant professor. You need 1,000 average calculators working at the exact same time.
You need a system of parallel busboys clearing every table in the restaurant simultaneously.
That is amazing.
And that is precisely what they realized. The CPU was never going to be good enough at doing the specific, repetitive, parallel math required for 3D environments.
So they needed a new approach entirely.
They realized they needed to design a completely new architecture, a dedicated processor just for the visuals, what we now call the GPU.
So they have the idea. They understand the first principles physics of what needs to be built. But they need a headquarters to actually draft the blueprints.
Right.
And this brings us right back to where the story started. It's late 1992, early 1993. The three founders need a cheap place to meet and argue over architectures. So where do they go?
A corner booth at a Denny's diner in San Jose, California.
It is incredibly poetic.
It really is.
They sat there for hours on end drinking bottomless coffee because it was cheap and the waitstaff wouldn't kick them out.
Jensen is back in a Denny's, but this time he isn't hauling a mountain of dirty plates. He is actively designing the blueprints for a technological revolution.
Though we should note, his transition from brilliant engineer to business mogul was not exactly seamless.
Definitely not.
There is this fantastic detail in the sources about their founding process.
Oh, the business plan.
Yes. Jensen knows they need a formal business plan to get venture capital funding. So he goes to a local bookstore and buys a massive 450-page textbook on how to write a business plan.
As one does.
Right. He sits down in that Benny's booth, reads a few pages, realizes how dense and theoretical it is, and literally tosses it aside.
Just gives up on it.
He says out loud, "I'll be broke by the time I finish reading this."
Which perfectly encapsulates his bias toward aggressive action.
Yeah.
He didn't have time for academic business theory when the practical reality of the market was moving so fast.
So what did he do instead?
Well, instead of a formal book-learned plan, he relied on his sheer instinct, his deep understanding of the Silicon market, and the sterling reputation he had built at LSI Logic.
And it pays off. In April 1993, they officially found the company.
They do.
They name it NVIDIA, derived from NVIDIA, the Latin word for envy. Their stated goal was to design graphics chips so fast and so revolutionary that the entire computing industry would be green with envy.
Love the confidence.
And if you look at the calendar, April 1993, Jensen Huang was exactly 30 years old.
He hit the deadline.
He actually hit the deadline. That wild, arrogant-sounding promise he made to Lori as a 20-year-old kid drawing circuits on a Sunday, well, he pulled it off.
He was a CEO.
But being a CEO on paper means nothing if you don't have capital to build the chips.
Right. And this is where his time at LSI Logic proved invaluable. LSI's founder, Wilfred Corrigan, had seen Jensen's relentless work ethic firsthand.
Okay.
Corrigan respected him so deeply that he made a personal introduction to Don Valentine.
Wow.
And Don Valentine wasn't just any investor. He was a legendary figure at Sequoia Capital.
Valentine was essentially the ultimate Silicon Valley kingmaker. If he backed you, the industry paid attention.
Exactly. Valentine was famous for investing in massive future markets, not just cool technology.
So Jensen had to sell him on the future.
He had to convince him that the market for 3D PC graphics, which, by the way, barely existed at the time, was going to be the next major frontier.
Yeah, it worked.
Because of Corrigan's vouch and Jensen's undeniable grasp of where the hardware market was heading, Sequoia backed them. They secured $20 million in venture funding.
I want to touch on why Jensen was the one pitching this and why he was the CEO. Chris and Curtis were older, right?
They were.
They had more experience at places like Sun Microsystems. So why did they hand the reins to the 30-year-old?
Because they recognized something unique in him. Curtis Prime later said that they explicitly told Jensen, "You run the company, do all the stuff we don't know how to do."
Which is a lot of trust.
It is. Chris and Curtis were brilliant technologists, but Jensen was that rare, vital hybrid. He was an engineer who deeply understood the silicon, but he also intuitively grasped the ruthless, pragmatic mechanics of business, supply chains, and market timing.
All skills honed during his rapid ascent at LSI. So we have traced this unbelievable trajectory from surviving the graveyard shift at a Denny's in Portland to securing $20 million to launch a company that will, decades later, provide the parallel computing power necessary to ignite the global AI revolution.
It's wild. When you step back and look at the entire narrative arc, it is a stunning journey. from the steaming dish sinks of Oregon to the corner booth of San Jose.
Truly.
In 2023, after NVIDIA officially crossed the threshold to become a $1 trillion company, Denny's actually installed a permanent metal plaque at that exact table in San Jose.
No way.
Yeah, it simply reads, "The booth that launched a $1 trillion company."
That is just incredible.
The 15-year-old boy who washed the dishes essentially bought the restaurant, metaphorically speaking, of course.
All right.
All the fear of being an immigrant, the deep introversion, the language barriers, he washed them down the drain in 1978. What was left behind was an utterly unbreakable will.
Wow. Leaves you with something profoundly challenging to chew on. Well, we live in a modern culture that is utterly obsessed with optimizing our comfort, you know. We download apps to avoid waiting in line. We curate algorithms to protect us from ideas we find annoying.
We essentially design our daily lives to avoid friction at all costs.
Right. But look at Jensen Huang. His self-proclaimed superpower was his good past. A past constructed entirely out of scrubbing toilets, profound sleep deprivation, and actively embracing low expectations.
It's a huge contrast.
It really makes you wonder, by constantly trying to insulate ourselves from hardship, are we accidentally depriving ourselves of the very pain and friction required to build our own resilience?
That is definitely something to think about.
Something to think about the next time you find yourself stuck doing the dirty work. Until next deep dive.
This program is produced and provided by lawyer Kyung Jin Kim.